Today, a coming-of-age story with razor-sharp political commentary, an inventive rewriting of human history, the science of animal-borne pathogens, good old-fashioned horror, and a lot of werewolves. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, a rebroadcast of my conversation with novelist Benjamin Percy about his novel Red Moon. I'll also talk with short story writer Ethan Rutherford about his book The Peripatetic Coffin and other stories. And it is our fall membership drive here on Iowa Public Radio. We're going to wrap things up early on Friday morning. Please make your contribution today at iowapublicradio.org. Join the conversation after the news. This is an archive edition of Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're going to talk about 21st century werewolves and a submarine crew of Confederate soldiers. Later in the hour, I'll talk with Ethan Rutherford about his new collection of short stories, The Peripatetic Coffin and other stories. But we'll start with the werewolves and the new novel, Red Moon. Author Benjamin Percy is here with me. Hello, Benjamin.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Welcome back to the show.
Happy to be here.
And there are a lot of people predicting that this book is going to do for werewolves what many other books in recent history have done for vampires. Where did the werewolves come from in your imagination?
Well, I've always been obsessed with them as a creature. I recently moved, and when pawing through some old boxes, came upon an artifact, a research paper that I wrote in sixth grade titled Werewolves with an exclamation mark. And the paper was only 5 pages long, but it had a table of contents, and the final section of this paper was called The Ceremony of the Wolf. And in my backyard, beneath a full moon, when 12 years old, I attempted to transform myself. And that's why I sound this way. and so this book has been a long time coming. But what really informed, I guess, the genesis of the novel was me considering what people fear right now and using the werewolf as sort of an allegorical way to approach that.
In the book, this isn't just sort of a stereotypical horror supernatural story. You build a universe that is very much like our own, clearly inspired by the politics of right now, of current events from right now. What made you want to bring the werewolves so close to our world?
Well, if you consider Frankenstein as a prime example of what I was trying to accomplish, Frankenstein makes the creature into an embodiment of all the anxiety swirling around the Industrial Revolution, the fear of man playing God, the fear of science and technology. And if you think of other fantasy stories throughout history, they're doing the same thing. They're channeling cultural unease. Think of Invasion of the Body Snatchers and how that targeted McCarthyism and the Red Scare. Think of The Dead Zone by Stephen King and the Cold War anxiety strung throughout that. Or think of 9/11. And the way that since then we've seen this slew of apocalyptic and post-apocalyptic narratives. So I was thinking about what we fear right now. And what we fear right now is, one, infection. And you need look no further than the entryways or countertops of any business in America to see the Purell oozing from it as evidence of that. Or the headlines and how they can be dominated by swine flu, by bird flu, by West Nile, by whatever outbreak is upon us. And then we fear as well terrorism.
Did you have a moment watching the news or finding out about something that was going on where you suddenly realized that that is where my werewolves need to be?
It wasn't when watching the news. It was when considering, you know, just the tenor of the moment, when trying to figure out how to take a knife to the nerve of the moment. And that was the hook that I hung the narrative on. And from there, that's when I began to develop the characters, you know, to sketch them out. And when I build a narrative, what I do is I think about a book almost a year in advance of composing it. So I hung from my office wall this 10-foot scroll ripped from my children's Melissa and Doug Arteezle. And, you know, I started with this idea of the post-9/11 reinvention of the werewolf myth. I started to draw like actually cartoon in characters and figure out like a Wikipedia entry on their history and then what they desired and then what obstacles I might put in the way of their desire and so on. So the genesis of it was all just that post 9/11 hook.
Could you read a little bit from the book for us, introduce us to the Lycan, your werewolves?
So the novel opens up with an attack. If you think about the Lycan, as I call them, instead of werewolves, because, you know, I'm trying to reinvent the myth, and Justin Cronin doesn't use the word vampire in the passage, and Robert Kirkman doesn't use the word zombie in The Walking Dead, so I thought I'd follow their tracks in the mud. So these Lycans are an oppressed portion of the population, and there's, of course, an uprising. And on the night of this terrorist attack, there's a swift government response. So I'm going to read briefly from one of the infected's storylines. This is Claire Forrester, who lives in Wisconsin and whose parents are part of a sort of weather underground movement back in the 60s that's supportive of the infected. She does not know what is happening outside right this minute as the small brigade of vehicles, the armored vans, the black sedans with government plates, appear at the end of her block with their headlights off. She lives in a wooded neighborhood, each house set back on a half-acre lot. There are no street lights, no sidewalk. The vehicles purr to a stop. Their doors swing open but do not close. Any noise that might bring Claire to the window, the stomp of boots along the asphalt, the clatter of assault rifles and ammunition clips, is muffled by the steady snowfall, a white shroud thrown over the night. She does not know about the tall man in the black suit and black necktie, his skull as hairless as a stone, who stands next to his black Lincoln town car. She does not know that he has his hands tucked into his pockets or that the snow is melting against his scalp and dripping down his face, or that he is smiling slightly. She does not know that her father and mother are sitting at the kitchen table drinking their way through a bottle of Merlot, not holding but squeezing each other's hands in reassurance as they watch CNN, the coverage of what the president called a coordinated terror attack directed at the heart of America. So she does not know that, when the front door kicks open, splintering along its hinges, her father is holding the remote in his hand, a long black remote that could be mistaken for a weapon. She does not know that he stands up so suddenly his chair tips over and clatters to the floor that he screams no and holds out his hand, the hand gripping the remote, and points it at the men as they come rushing through the entryway, the dark rectangle of night with snow fluttering around them like damp shredded paper. She only knows when she hears the crash, the screams, the rattle of gunfire, that she must run.
Benjamin Percy reading from his novel Red Moon. When you started to rewrite history, you mentioned that character, Claire, she's grown up as a fairly normal teenager in spite of the fact that she is infected, as you say. And she's infected because her parents are infected. This is something that could be passed down from generation to generation. She doesn't know anything about her parents' activist past, and she's just a teenager who likes being a teenager, is ready to leave home, really ready to leave home. But as she goes through the story, she learns more about their past and about the past of the Lycan, this people who have been fighting for equality in the United States and around the world. As you rewrote our history, You basically took the civil rights movement and gave it to the Lycan. Why did you decide that would be their history?
Well, in prehistoric times, I have this disease leaping out of the wolf population and mutating in its human host. And this segment of the population is marginalized, and in many ways they come to represent the other. And it's an all-encompassing other, because when I began to do the reverse engineering on this story, which is set now, I figured out that, okay, how would the Crusades be affected by this? How would westward expansionism be affected by this? How would World War II? How would the Civil Rights Movement? How would this post 9/11 era finally be affected? And I'm talking about, you know, the politics, the cultural conflicts, even economic ramifications. And in this world-building opportunity, what I guess I was doing was holding up a mirror to this world with a crack running through it. And you can recognize perhaps certain political figures, cultural conflicts, international battles, even diseases. But I hope that the reflection is warped enough or blurred enough that it's more like a big tangled-up ball of frayed nerves. And you might be able to make the connection to blacks as well as Muslims, as well as homosexuals, as well as, you know, you could just fill in the gap there regarding just oppression and people rallying together to battle back against those who try to marginalize them.
You make an interesting choice as you put these people throughout history, and we see them in different places throughout history as Claire is learning about her own history. But you make an interesting choice in that not all the monsters in our society are lichen. There's a moment where on a college campus that is it's in a lichen university, so all of the students there are lichen. One of the students says something, I think, about, well, you know, there's Jeffrey Dahmer and John Wayne Gacy, and you don't think all 30-year-old men are monsters because of them.
Sure.
But it would have been very easy to turn serial killers into lichen. Was that a pointed decision on your part to make sure that we knew that not all the monsters are monsters?
Yeah, well, my characters are the infected and the uninfected. They're men and women. They're young and old. They're from all sorts of different geographic and religious and cultural backgrounds. And that idea is like capture all these myriad perspectives on a very complicated issue. And, you know, in talking about the lichen population in the novel, I show how there are more shark attacks in here than there are lichen attacks. That it's hate crimes and it's paranoia that has resulted in all this prejudice.
Clearly, you paid a lot of attention to current events, a lot of attention to history when you wrote this book, and you wove so much of that into the story. But you've also done quite a bit of research about animal-borne pathogens as well, although clearly there is not a disease that can turn you into a werewolf. But what were the diseases that inspired your disease?
Well, I was living in Ames, Iowa for 4 years, and during that time befriended quite a few people at the university, and also ended up working out at the gym with people who were at the USDA labs. And so I was able to tap into that population and mine them for information. I consider every story to be a research project. If I'm writing about a taxidermist, we'll visit a taxidermy studio and sniff the formaldehyde and clack the glass eyeballs around in my palm and stroke the polyurethane forms and eavesdrop on the people working there to capture that insider lingo. And in this book, I mean, there's just so much that I didn't know. I had to talk to politicians, government agents, brewmasters, Marines, and of course, these researchers. And I filled up maybe 12 yellow legal tablets with information about this animal-borne pathogen, which is akin to mad cow disease or chronic wasting disease. I'm talking about prions, the misfolded proteins that target the mind. And there's really not a lot known about them. So
And we don't know how to cure the problems that they cause either.
Right. And so I was able to, you know, create a kind of slippery science that made my lichens, my werewolves, into not full moon howlers, but instead a believable horror. And hopefully by the end of this book, you'll believe in the possibility of this actually happening. And as a result, you know, I don't focus so much on the tooth and claw element of transformation. It's more about the reason that we're drawn to the werewolf myth is because it's that battle between ego and id. We have all come unhinged. We've all come unleashed at some point in our lives and come to regret our behavior. And that's why Jekyll and Hyde resonates. That's why The Incredible Hulk resonates. And that's the psychological angle that I was trying to tackle with this novel.
This pathogen is obviously different from mad cow disease, different from chronic wasting disease, in that your characters who are infected can live full, healthy lives.
Indeed. They can live these full, healthy lives, and they can be in control of the disease, potentially. There are some long-lasting effects that I get into. I mean, I spread these chunks of exposition all throughout the novel so as not to exhaust the reader. But what I was trying to do is, you know, with credibility, talk about infection, about mutation, about vaccination, and the way that this, you know, segment of the population, they're forced to take this emotionally deadening drug called Vulpex. And as a result of that, you know, the rage and the sort of sexual impulse that can go along with the Lobos infection, that part of their identity dies.
My conversation with author Benjamin Percy continues in just a moment. You're listening to a rebroadcast of Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. You're listening to an archived edition of Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today, we're listening back to my conversation with author Benjamin Percy about his book, Red Moon, the world's first 9/11 werewolf book. How long did you spend working on this book?
I thought about it for a year. I blueprinted it for a year, which makes the actual composition process a lot swifter. And so, under the gun, and this is when I was at Iowa State University, I was writing, you know, 8 hours a day, 10 hours a day, because I sold this book based on 65 pages and an outline. And they said, you need to hand this into us in a year's time.
Wow.
So I had 65 pages, I had my outline, and then I had a year. And I went into my cave and didn't come out.
And this is a big novel. This is 530 pages long.
And I cut 100 pages out of it, at least.
Wow. So I really, really enjoyed the book. And this is, we've talked about a little bit about how this is genre bending, but this is not a genre that I normally delve into myself. But the book, I mean, it really sucked me in as a reader, as all really great books do. As a writer, did you find yourself sort of living in this dark hole of a world that you created? Was that difficult?
Well, you know, I might write for 8 hours a day in my cobwebby dungeon of an office. But at the end of that day, I go upstairs and I play pretty ponies with my daughter, you know, so I don't live in darkness. I work in darkness. And I will also just think about, if you think about this as a love story meant to quicken the pulse and a political allegory meant to provoke thoughtful discussion and a horror story meant to scare the pants off of you, like I am being manipulative, as every author is, when trying to make you gasp or make you laugh or make you lose some sleep. So, you know, I'm very strategic in the way that I implant darkness into my narrative. And actually, when I was talking about that, that scroll that I keep in my office wall where I'm figuring out all the plot points and the character arcs, like over the top of that, I put a suspense-o-meter, which sort of looks like a cardiogram or a seismograph. I'm trying to figure out the spikes and the drops in the narrative, the peaks and the valleys. And I'm carefully considering the orchestration of fear in that way.
The last time we talked, your first novel, The Wilding, had just come out, and you had already sold this novel and the movie rights to this novel as well. Is the movie already in the works?
Well, I hadn't finished the novel, and so the rights were purchased, but there was no story. And so they waited for me, and in the process of that waiting, we became kind of sort of dissatisfied with the situation, and so we took it off the market until I was done. And now, starting today, it's officially up again.
Okay.
And so I can't say who, but we've received some preliminary offers, and over the next four days, I'm going to be conference calling. So, paws crossed.
Is that a process that you want to be involved in, or are you hoping that someone will give you a nice chunk of change and you can move on and do other things?
I am interested in being involved, and I've been paired with James Ponsoldt, whose recent indie dramas, The Spectacular Now and Smashed, have received a lot of attention at Sundance and at Toronto. So we're paired to write the screenplay together. and he could potentially become director as well, but that's up for debate. So we'll see what happens with us as dueling scribes. I really feel like it's better this way in order for me to like remain the country rube. Like I've got my 4 acres of wilderness, you know, and I like to play around with chainsaws and fire arrows at the moon, and I can just live out in the boonies. And then I've got this other guy who's on the ground in Hollywood, and he can go out for lunch with them and live that lifestyle. I just, you know, I want to have my foot in it, but I don't want to live in LA.
This book has already gotten a lot of attention, a lot of really good reviews, and a lot of pop culture, very high profile pop culture reviews. It's on Entertainment Weekly's must list, that kind of thing. How has that changed the kind of attention you're getting?
Well, I have to say the Entertainment Weekly thing was pretty amazing, in that I'm a, you know, that's one of my guilty pleasures is reading Entertainment Weekly, and I had no idea, and I popped open the issue, and there I am, like right next to Jay-Z, which was pretty cool. So they keep mentioning me somehow for some reason, like they're too kind. Maybe the bribes that I've been sending them in the mail have paid off. But, you know, it's 3 issues in a row now they mentioned me, so I'm really grateful for that sort of thing. And that, you know, what I'm hoping is that, you know, I'm trying to write a novel that's carefully composed, that's artful in its technique, that has subterranean themes, that has glowing metaphors, that has three-dimensional characters. You know, I'm trying to draw upon that literary background that I know so well, and that's sort of like the circles that I've been in the past few years. But I'm also trying to like write the kind of book that I grew up reading and I never fell out of love with, which is pop fiction, like story first. Most people read for escapism. Most people read to discover what happens next. And I wanted to write something that was both like a beach read that you could sink your claws into and, you know, a book that might provoke a really thoughtful response when it comes to its subtext. So the fact that I'm in EW and being reviewed in the New York Times Book Review, like those sort of things, like hand in hand, like that's exactly what I was hoping for. And I just feel, I guess, incredibly grateful.
I've read that when you started getting involved in MFA programs and in the higher education and pursuing a writing career, that your interest in horror was discouraged.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up on genre. Everybody does. I'm obsessed with mysteries, obsessed with fantasy novels. Like anything with a dragon on the cover was really exciting to me. You know, sci-fi, spy thrillers, whatever. But horror always, like that was the section of the bookstore I returned to again and again. And when I arrived at my first creative writing workshop in college, and on the first day was told by the instructor genre was forbidden, I very earnestly threw up my hand and asked, like, what else is there? Like, to me, that was storytelling. And though I fell in love with literary fiction thereafter, you know, everyone from Sherman Alexie to Alice Munro to Flannery O'Connor to Tim O'Brien, authors I'd never heard of before, even though I fell in love with literary fiction, I also never fell out of love with genre, and really feel like this day, especially in this day and age, it has become more and more acceptable to blur those lines. And if you look at Michael Chabon and Jonathan Lethem as cheerleaders of this form, and if you look at authors like Margaret Atwood or Cormac McCarthy, like what part of the bookstore do they belong in? Shouldn't they just as easily be in sci-fi as they could be in literature? Like these phantom barricades that people try to set up, tagging you as genre or as literary or as whatever. Like I'm not sure why all this effort, and that, you know, either your book is compellingly written or not. And I guess I'm hoping to neither be fish nor fowl, both pop fiction and literary fiction. And if you think about like realism, everybody's saying, well, you know, this is a departure, these supernatural fiction and such, as though realism is the only way to write. You know, realism is the trend. Look at what's been written throughout history. You know, realism has only become like the standard since the 1960s. So I feel like I'm just, you know, I'm writing the sort of fiction that I grew up with. I'm writing the sort of fiction that I always hope to compose. And pretty sentences and exploding helicopters. How's that for a pairing?
When you got that pushback, when you started in this education world, did you think, maybe I'm in the wrong place? Did you think about leaving?
There was a slow acclimation. I wasn't sure at first that I wanted to be a writer. It was more something I was flirting with on the side. But then I became obsessed and was waking up at 4:30 in the morning to write and was reading everything that I could get my hands on in order to catch up with the rest of the class. But I have to say that when I was in these courses, I was drawn to writers like Ambrose Bierce, or I was drawn to Flannery O'Connor, in part because I recognized, or Shirley Jackson, and that I recognized what they were doing as close cousins to what I'd been reading before, as opposed to maybe, I don't know, the hyper-literary work of other authors that I initially found off-putting, wondering like, okay, what happens in the story? Somebody drinks a cup of tea, looks out the window at a, you know, boiling bunch of clouds and has an orgasmic epiphany. Like, it's, you know, it's quite beautiful in the way it's told, but nothing happens.
So as you were writing and sharing your work with fellow students, did you continue to get pushback on writing horror stories? Because I'm sure you did. I've read two of your novels now, and I'm sure a lot of your stories were.
Yeah, people would try to, you know, this is sci-fi, this is horror. Or, as one instructor put it, I hate this story. That was actually my first graduate class, my first graduate workshop, and I was the first person up, and the instructor said to kick things off, I hate this story. But thankfully, I'm, you know, bullheaded enough, that sort of thing.
So what did you get out of all of that? I mean, clearly you read a lot of people that you wouldn't have read. So mm-hmm. You read a lot of great authors that you didn't have exposure to before. But how do you think that whole process shaped you?
Well, I learned how to be a careful carpenter. I acquired a literary arsenal. The reason that, you know, if you want to become a great athlete, what you do is you watch a lot of footage and you figure out the way that this ball player is lifting their elbow when swinging at the plate, or you look at the way that this athlete is flicking his wrist when tossing up a free throw, and you study plays, and the same thing goes for a painter. Like, you go to the museum and you study all these different artists and you set up your easel and you try to, you know, roughly paint, sort of play with light like Van Gogh, not because you want to be Van Gogh, but because you want to steal, like, pirate the different tricks that they employ. So I think it's incredibly important that I studied both, like, people, that I studied the Dragonlance series and the Forgotten Realm series as much as it was that I studied Alice Munro, and that I'm able to sort of figure out all these different things about how to make a reader, both appreciate artful technique and just like, how do you throw gas on the fire? How do you make the engine roar? How do you make people race forward when reading? So that they're turning pages so swiftly it makes a breeze on their face.
Also joining today's conversation is short story writer Ethan Rutherford. He's the author of The Peripatetic Coffin and other stories. I asked him to share a little bit about the title story and his inspiration.
So the story that I'm going to read from is, and actually I was thinking maybe I should just pay Ben $20 to go ahead and read this excerpt as well, just to sort of make people rush out and get it. So the story I'm going to read from is The Peripatetic Coffin, which is the name that they gave the H.L. Hunley, which was the first Confederate submarine that actually saw action and sort of succeeded and then sank. So it's the first story in the collection, and it was in the Best American Short Stories a while ago. So when it came time to title the collection, they're like, well, listen, that's, you know, the only thing that people have heard about. So there it goes. I'm just going to read, I suppose, probably the first couple pages here.
Great.
The Peripatetic Coffin. The sound of iron walls adjusting to the underwater pressure around you was like the sound of improbability announcing itself, a broad, deep, awake you from your stupor kind of salvo. The first time we heard it, we thought we were dead. The second time we heard it, we realized we were. The third time wiped clean away any concern we had regarding our well-being, and we whooped like madmen in our sealed iron tub, hands at the crank, hunched at our stations like crippled industrial workers. Frank yelled like a siren without taking a breath. Augustus hooted like a screech owl. The walls pinged and groaned but held their seams. We screamed for more. My name is Ward Lumpkin, and I man the second crank station aboard the fishboat H.L. Hunley, the first underwater vessel commissioned for combat by the Confederate States of America. There are seven of us aboard, not including our captain, Lieutenant Dixon. And in navigating the submarine Merc of Charleston Harbor, we make up the third volunteer crew in as many months. Mechanical failure, flooding ballast tanks, human error, bad luck. Conventional wisdom around Battery Marshall has the survival rate aboard the Hunley hovering near zero, and that's without ever having engaged an enemy ship. Cannon probability, Augustus calls it, as in stuff yourself inside a cannon and see what happens. But there's probability and there's certainty. Antietam was a washout. Gettysburg was worse. Crescent City folded like the house of cards it was, and we lost the Mississippi. One thing, at least, is clear to everyone. The Union naval blockade encircling Charleston must be broken if we are to continue aggression with the North. And if things are ever going to roll our way, it'll be by doing the unexpected. General to germ soaker, we fold our hats and stand in awe before the ingenuity of this machine, a cylindrical steam boiler, lengthened and tapered at the ends, outfitted with conning towers, a propeller, and diving fins. Affixed to our bow is a 17-foot-long iron spar torpedo that carries 135 pounds of gunpowder, which Frank has taken to calling the demoralizer. We are the unheard of, an instrument of destruction that maneuvers under the waves. If we survive our test dives, if we make it past Breach Inlet without rolling in the tide, if we crank undetected the 3 miles from the mouth of Charleston Harbor, it's enough ordnance to send any ship we happen to greet to the bottom of the ocean. Desperation breeds invention, Arnold has begun saying, each time he seals the hatch. May wonders never cease, Frank says back.
Ethan Rutherford reading from the story, The Peripatetic Coffin, which is the title story of his new collection, The Peripatetic Coffin and Other Stories. I was talking to Ben earlier about the research that he did into history, into politics, into animal-borne pathogens. When writing historical fiction like this, how much research did you do to find out about the Confederate soldiers who would have been on this ship?
Just enough to sort of pull off the story, I guess. I mean, one of the things, and I think that Ben would agree, we've talked about this, one of the great pleasures in sort of writing stories is the research component. And so for me, when I'm sitting down to write my stories, I read a lot about ships or about boats or about sort of historical things, just sort of waiting for that moment where you can jump in and you can say, aha, this is sort of getting my attention. There's something about this that I'd like to explore. And so with this particular story, I was living down in Charleston, and they have a replica of the Hunley down there, and it really is the most insane thing that you've ever seen. The idea that anybody would get aboard this thing and sort of bike pedal it underwater to basically ram a ship is just insanity. And so that the first seed was walking by that thing and saying, you know, who in their right mind would ever get aboard this thing? And then suddenly going, hey, that's the character that I'm interested in. And then the trick becomes, how do you make this believable? I don't know. I still don't know anything about the Civil War. But then that's where the research starts, and you try to fill sort of the gaps in your knowledge. And so I ended up finding a children's book about the Hunley, which gave me all the information I needed about conning towers and, you know, diving fins and stuff like that. And then there's the story. So for me, the historical stories that I write, and there's another story in this book about a Russian ship that's sort of locked in ice and is drifting north towards the Arctic. There's a story set in the future. I guess this is sci-fi. We're talking about genre, about whalers in the future when there's no water, so they're on sand. The stuff that you're interested in, it's less sort of the historical story than the characters that you're sort of spending time with.
Do you think there's a danger of doing too much research,
sucked
in too far?
Oh, absolutely. Because it's really fun to read about these periods and to sort of feel yourself getting immersed in it. But you can definitely go down rabbit holes. You know, you go, oh, they had submarines. You're like, oh, wait a second. They also had a balloon corps. And then also there was like a polar bear army. And then before you know it, you're just sort of in a Wikipedia wormhole and you're exhausted and you never sort of get to finish the story. The important thing for me is to stop right when I am the most interested in a sort of a period of history, because otherwise you read, you find out what happened, and then you go, well, you know, why would I have to tell that story? You know, what else is left?
So once you get to that point, what happens next for you?
I try to turn off the computer, and I try to stop researching and just try to draft the story as much as I possibly can. And then you send it to people who might know about that that period in history. And so in this particular story, as like, you know, these guys said, man, we are certainly shell-shocked. And somebody pointed out that that wasn't a word that was even sort of employed until after the First World War. So then you go back and you go, okay, that's inaccurate. That doesn't work. That doesn't work. That doesn't work. And you just sort of trim it down.
Why do you think it is that short story collections seem to be so much harder to get attention for than novels? There, I mean, there have been so many fabulous short story collections, but it is a very rare collection that makes it to the top.
Yeah, although A Visit to the Goon Squad won the Pulitzer recently, and George Saunders has had a huge book, and they're calling this the Year of the Short Story, which I'm just crossing my fingers that some of that rubs off for this book. I don't know. It's a mystery because it's the sort of thing that you go, well, listen, this is only going to take up, you know, if a short story is done well, I mean, it's a gut punch and you can get that in sort of 20 minutes of reading. I don't know. I mean, I think a lot of us really love the immersive experience of reading a novel that is 600 pages and you become familiar with characters. And I think in some ways novels sort of answer questions, and I think short stories are sort of engineered. They're, you know, these little sort of Swiss clocks that kind of ask questions. And I think that sometimes people just prefer to be around, you know, that really immersive reading experience. But, you know, all of my favorite writers are short story writers. But at a certain point, it starts to feel like a Willie Nelson song, you know, where mamas, don't let your children grow up to be short story writers. But it's great. I mean, it's been wonderful to sort of see the book out there and to hear from people about, you know, various short stories.
Ben, since you've also written a lot of short stories, what makes a story a short story or a novel for you? How do you know?
Well, it has everything to do with how compelling these characters are and how difficult their problems are, how much time you're willing to spend with them. You know, a short story is all about flash and brilliance. It's all about the Swiss watch metaphor or the finely cut diamond. You know, it's about this. You're dashing into a life. You're getting a glimpse of a life as opposed to experiencing a life. Which is what a novel supplies you with. And when Ethan said that a short story raises questions and doesn't necessarily answer them, that's a very wise way of putting it, in that the short story almost always ends ambiguously, as opposed to a novel's expectation, which is to take you to some sort of conclusion in which the trouble is resolved. Things are sometimes just getting warmed up with a short story. So you drop into this life and, you know, you get a dose of emotional turmoil, and then you're in white space before you know it. But the thing about a short story is the way that it continues to live with you for that reason. When you hit the white space and there's that question mark at the end, you become almost a co-author. There's a partnership, an emotional partnership. You become complicit in the narrative. And for that reason, I can remember many short stories better than I can novels, because I feel like they've become like embedded in the fiber of my mind.
Author Benjamin Percy, whose latest novel is Red Moon, now out in paperback. We also heard this hour from Ethan Rutherford, the author of the collection of short stories, The Peripatetic Coffin and Other Stories. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbie.